You can forget the rest of the world exists. It's going to be a beautiful thing.
Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most Ducker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hello and welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, Beyond the Bell of Souls podcast. I'm joined by Tanya Gates.
Hi, everybody.
And Adam Camilleri.
Evening.
How's everybody doing today?
I'm good. It's a little bit, you know, wet in the desert right now, which is strange. But other than that, I'm doing good.
I am recovering from my favorite event of the past LVO, which is the ATC or the ANZTC. Just trying to catch up on sleep, man.
I'm sure you feel the same in there, so we know it's, you know, international. Because I was gonna say the ATC, that's coming up in July. That's here. That's near me.
Excuse me, but I think that you're actually the odd one out when saying Z.
Yes.
Still a niner in there.
What? Still such a strange distinction to make. If you thought there'd be things that, you know, we would standardize, I thought, you know, everyone drives on the same side of the street, everyone uses the same like electrical plugs, and we all say it either Z or Z. We all say the same one. Why is it different? Perplexing. The big questions. That's what we're here
because
for.
Because we all have to be unique snowflakes. That's why.
That's what right. Use and armor and color.
Mm.
It's a weird world we're living.
But I want all my space marines to be this primary color. No, we have to be this primary color. You imagine like the emperor arguing with his other, like, you know, gene enhancers when they're cooking up the space marines and like, what should colors they should be? And he's just like, one of every color, whatever. Just get it done.
It works. On this show, we got a pretty cool special segment to insert in this. I talked with Kicker from Frontline Gaming in the middle of this show. We talk about some of the things they have going on over there. And man, his enthusiasm is, you know, it just permeates. It's going to come through the speakers. You don't want to miss that segment. And just to basically feel what it's like, you know, with him being an event organizer. It's great.
He is an infectious soul. Very lovely man. Took me out for dinner when I was in New Orleans with him and his lovely wife. Great, great, great dude.
We'll talk about the US Open Series on here from Games Workshop. Got San Diego coming up in a couple of weeks.
Oh, dude, it's, yeah. Big couple of weeks for you, and we haven't been on to talk about it because a lot went down, and some of it was a bit unusual as well.
Oh, you mean talking about in Seattle?
Yeah, dude, there was some surprise, some upsets.
There were I don't think anyone was like shocked to see the Tyranid versus Tyranid final.
Nah. But the lead up, the top eight was way more diverse and interesting than I thought it would be.
It really was. And I think that on one of the other, like I'll try to post some links in the show notes. We're going to be talking with the player that played Orcs that, you know, could have taken it all, was right in position to take it all.
He's the guy I'm talking about. He literally shook up the world, you know. There's a great line from a famous podcaster when he was doing like some fight commentary. He walks up to the guy who just won and says, "Yo, you just shook up the world." And the guy's like, "I'm not surprised." Yeah, it's a great moment.
It's funny you say the surprise because that's, you know, when we have that conversation probably over on the Art of War channel, surprise is going to come up.
Yeah, dude. He's a very interesting cat and his list is super unconventional, so you should definitely tune in. Is it Blood Axes? Blood Axe Orcs?
It was, yeah.
Not even what you'd assume would be like the full, you know, rush.
Not a kill rig in sight.
Yeah, get out. You know, you'd assume if you saw a top table orc list, you'd be like, it'd be goths. It'd be just waves and waves and waves of aggression, trying to drown them out, outlast them, make sure they don't get a good score. But this guy was playing more of the jank tank, and it really interesting stuff.
Yeah, no spoilers because I know there's going to be a lot to talk about. I wanted to give the opportunity to unpack that, and you know, but that kind of plays into, you know, what one of the things that we talk about is we do these type of meta analysis is that, you know, any given Sunday.
Yeah, true. You know, right player, right list, right time. You can get a lot done.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So coming up, which I'm really looking forward to, I've never been to San Diego before. It is June 10th through the 12th. I think technically, you know, you can get registered in the 9th. If anybody isn't familiar with it or didn't know it was coming up and you're in the area or you can make it, it's not just a Warhammer 40,000 event. There's also hobby classes. There's Kill Team. There's Sigmar. It's like a full package event. And this will be one where the game Strange Workshop store is, you know, Forge World, things you can't get everywhere. You might get the opportunity to get them there. So if you are in the area, you might want to come check it out just for the views, you know, and seeing people's armies they've put so much time and love into and, you know, carried from all over the country and sometimes the world. It's a truly international event.
I was in San Diego, directly following LVO this year. It's a cool town, man. Real cruisy, good vibe. Not too busy, not too quiet. It's just right.
Just tell me there are good hamburgers and tacos.
Oh, the food was amazing. Actually, surprisingly, the Italian food was extremely good.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, did not expect it.
Y'all know I love to eat. It's like one of the neatest things about this hobby is that I've been able to go places I might not have gone normally and get to do things that I love, such as eat and play Warhammer.
I can attest to it. Unfortunately, unlike me, you don't carry it as much.
You got to pick and choose. You got to get in and get a taco, get a burger. You know, it's like gotta pick and choose.
Just going to tell you right now, I eat a lot better than Paul does, and Paul looks in much better shape than I do. And I jog most days. it's infuriating.
I'll try not to rub it in too much as I'm eating these tacos, you know?
Yeah.
But I am looking forward to it. I'll put the link in the show notes. If anyone is just kind of curious as to what goes on at these things, you know, we live stream, we broadcast the tournament. So we'll actually be broadcasting the Warhammer 40,000 side of it. We'll try to be bringing news from the weekend to the live stream. But, you know, if you want to see what kind of events are at these things, check out the event listing, and I will put a link in the show notes. You know, we talk about destination events, and there are many of them. You know, thankfully, we are in America, in the States, we have many destination events, but this is definitely in that category of destination event.
Well, and people have a perception that these are fully competitive events, but these are more like a melding between a competitive event and a games day. If you can remember that far back to the some of the glory, you know, I think it was about third ed to fifth ed and kind of the start of sixth ed, when we used to have like a couple of games days a year or some hard boys, things like this, where there was a bit of pageantry, some soft scores, some real benefit to putting your best foot forward hobby-wise, as well as on the tabletop in gameplay. So it really is it's a holistic event, a holistic thing to attend.
The format of the event is one is such that it cuts to brackets after round four. So at that point in time, you then start a new competition essentially between people with similar records to yours that weekend. So you are competing for the top spots in those brackets.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get what are probably, you know, competitive or comparative games against players that are doing similarly to you. Now, look, I'm not saying there can't be blowouts. There could definitely be some upsets and normal games of Warhammer 40,000, but even if you do take a loss early in the event, you're not like out of the running for award competitions kind of thing, if that's something that you're looking to achieve.
Yeah, this is I think a great change in a lot of ways to a conventional tournament. Not that I have anything against conventional tournaments. I am the flavor of I'm of the opinion I like variety. I do like pod systems. I like bracket systems. I like top cuts. I like just 8-round grind, the player you're closest to on scores, the player you play next kind of stuff. Don't mind. I like the variety. But yeah, this one is good for if it's going to be a 3-day 8 gamer and you want to see as many people play all 8 games, this is a great way to do it, to keep the incentives high.
I'm right there with you. I do like the options with different formats. And look, I think, like now more than ever, maybe, you know, it's been this way for years, is that the tournament organizers are kind of empowered to experiment with their format, whatever, you know, works in their area, what they think the players want. And, you know, thankfully all this stuff is published, so people kind of know what to expect when they get to the tournaments.
Well, yeah, spot on. And just like, I mean, at a baseline, you have to kind of give people what they want, right? You have to, it is kind of a customer, purchaser exchange. There is an exchange of money. There is an exchange of expectations about what is being purchased with that money. And, you know, if you are paying to play in 8 games, you the tournament guys should be giving you every reason to play all 8 games and to enjoy them, to enjoy all of them.
In the competitive turn, environment.
Round. Yeah.
You know, beyond just the thrill of rolling dice, which is also cool because, you know, as you know, sometimes that may be the only 8 games, the only games you get a certain, you know, within that quarter, that year, or that month, or whatever.
Hmm. Well, Tanya, you're gearing up for a 1,000 point Age of Sigmar event, yeah?
I am, yeah. Super excited. It's, I think, the second week of June, and I'll be traveling down to Vancouver for it. It's a charity event, so You know me and Charity.
Hey, we got the charitable foundation coming up later on. Well, we'll be talking about that as the Nova Open Charitable Foundation as we get closer to it. So we do like charity around here.
That's right. So yeah. I thought, like, there's no better event for me to, like, dip my Age of Sigmar toes into than a charity one. And yeah, so just painting away, and I've been playing the same 1,000-point list for, like, I think 6 weeks or something like that. And yeah, just getting reps in, learning how my list works, how it works into different matchups and things, and what my weak matchups are, what my good matchups are. So,
what are your weak matchups?
Definitely Caradhran Overlords. I just don't have enough units to be able to screen them out, because the boats, like, deep strike every turn. They can. So that's a hard one for me. And what else is a hard one? Oh, yeah. The Stormcast with the dragons and things can be a little bit tough.
The dragons,
I think,
are rough on everybody right now.
I think that's they're a universal.
Yeah, they're just, like, not bad at anything, really, those
and don't
dragons.
They get to... They basically get to Overwatch, talking in Warhammer 40k terms, and do tons of damage.
I'm not too sure about that.
You'll be on the lookout. I don't know for sure that happens, but I think that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're just, like, super good at everything. And if you take them in, I think it's Cities of Sigmar or something like that, they can, like, shoot and then move after. And it's just, like, ridiculous. So... Yeah, and then in terms of, like, good matchups, like, Cruel Boys are a pretty good matchup. I do pretty good into, like, a Maggotkin. So, yeah, I'm excited to get some games in against people I don't know, and hopefully some factions I don't get to play against very often.
Nice. I got to play Chaos Knights versus Tau a couple days ago. I was playing Chaos Knights. My opponent was playing Tau. We set up on the, with using the GW U.S. Open Series terrain format, which I like, and the first time they'd played on it, so it was like mastering the angles of fire was a bit of a challenge for them. But that's one of the things, you know, if when you are going to an event, you know, look at what they're doing for terrain and doing a practice, which they did not do. We were playing a very casual, just fun pickup game, almost, you know, basically. I was just trying out the knights for the first time.
I'm going to be picking up this new knight book because I think it's real fun. I'll be doing the Imperial side, so maybe we can have a little throwdown sometime.
That'd be nice. A little bit of giant robot battle.
Mm-hmm.
I took one Abominant and 10 of the War Dog size knights.
That one Abom and 10 War Dogs. Okay, that's pretty good. I think I'm going to start conventional because, like, my first foray into knights. I owned 3 big knights already. 2 of them new on sprue. 1 of them's, like, fully magnetized. And so I think I'm just going to buy 2 boxes of War Glaives, and I'll just go 3 big, 4 little. That seems like a fun time.
That seems pretty good. So it seems like the Chaos Knights seem to play better with more of the smaller knights. And the Imperial Knights seem to play better with more of the larger knights. And
they've injected. It's really cool the yin and yang of the two books when you put them side by side. I haven't done a full, like, cover to cover go through of the Chaos Knight book, but everything I hear tells me to believe that the Chaos Knights can stack uber crazy combos on single knights, but the Imperial Knights have more layered buffs, like more auras, and it's kind of reminiscent of what they're all about, right? Like, the Chaos Knights are like personal glory.
Yeah, every person
structured.
For themselves.
Yeah. It's really cool. If that was the design, well done.
I think that's the case. And whereas the Imperial Knights is more like knight and squire type situation.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah.
That's what it feels like. And I did that exact same thing. So I had one Abominant, which I gave the undivided ability to the Dark Pantheon. I'm spacing on the name, or essentially, but the one that gives it the 2+ armor save, gave him another warlord trait that allows him to two additional wounds and heal the 3 wounds per turn. Gave the psychic power that reduces leadership and makes people take a leadership test when they are, you know, dread test when they want to do certain things on the tabletop, and then gave it the ability to potentially give out a feel no pain buff to people around, to the knights around them, you know, if you're all well enough. So pretty durable. And then it took an infernal house that allowed the carnivores move 14. So they're very fast.
That's a lot.
And you can take mortal wounds to either roll randomly on a chart to give yourself some additional movement, or take a potential of a lot of mortal wounds to pick that you want to move 3 extra inches. So moving 17 across the table on turn one is, you know, the first time someone sees that, they might be a little alarmed.
Who can blame them?
Yeah, when you're trying to pull off of essentially a pretty short charge. And then the Wardogs have a strat that if one of them makes it in, they basically kind of inspire the Wardogs around them to get rerolls to charge. So yeah. you can create some pretty explosive turns. And so all that happened.
just happened.
Yeah, so it was cool to get the big Stompy Knights and scores. The way their secondaries work, I think they're attainable. Like the game's done a pretty good job of to where Knights, I think, in previous editions, it's where they just had a hard time interacting with objectives. And I think the way the structure of the secondaries work in this edition of the game, they found a way to kind of make it attainable, but not pushed to one way or the other.
Yeah, it seemed like the case where you could... you could deny primary points, but you couldn't necessarily hold them yourself or vice versa. And it always seemed like there was always one really, really awkward secondary choice. Like one of your secondaries was just never going to get you a good score.
Yeah. And I did find I had a hard time kind of picking that third secondary. But I find that that's actually something that unless I've played the army in and out, I sometimes struggle with that third secondary.
Well, I like that being part of the game. I mean, we had versions of other mission packs where... other versions of this mission pack as well, where it was just a little bit too intuitive. Like, I like the hard decision. Like, if my opponent and I both have to make a hard decision on our last secondary, that being another factor that could decide the game, I think is an exciting thing to add. So, yeah, I like it. I like the hard decisions. I like, you know, am I going to get 7 or 8 on this third secondary? And my opponent got 8, I got 7. Oh, wow, I lost. Like, you know, these things you can go and look back on and assess and reassess and learn.
I don't know if this is, you know, the list, quote unquote, yet, but it was an Abominant. I had 3 of the Autocannon Knights. Total of 5 of the Melta Chain Axe Knights, and then 2 Carnivores.
The Carnivores are the new ones with the machine guns, yeah, and the claws?
No, 2 double close combat.
Oh, yeah, that's... Oh, dude, they're really good. And they're my favorite model. My favorite knight model now is the Lancer, and then that one.
And
the Lancer is too cool.
So I was a firm believer in, like, if you can get indirect fire, then you just take it, you know, especially if you can get it for basically, you know, without much of inconvenience. But I found myself, like, just kind of wishing I had the heavy stubber on him because of the way the changes to indirect fire.
I agree. I played an event this weekend. I actually played in the prestigious and awesome Australian Team Championships, well, Australian New Zealand Team Championships, yeah, like I said, which is our...
Zed.
Got to have the Zed. Even though they didn't send a team this year because of COVID's made it a little bit messy for them. A lot more restrictions traveling internationally between us. But and he's gone by. This is the national level championships event between every state in Australia sends a representative team. Usually you try and get your 8 best players together. That'll work together well and create a cohesive unit. And you send it off to the wherever the championship's been held that year. And I was coach for a team. And then one of our guys, unfortunately, got COVID and I ended up having to play. And I played an Eldar list that just happened to have 3 Shadow Weavers in it. And I played, four of the 5 rounds, I played against armies that had Armor of Contempt. And those Shadow Weavers, like, if they did a wound, I was chuffed. Like, you know, if they did a wound to an intercessor, I was like, go, you good thing, you know, good for you. Cause they just don't do much at the moment. But I played one game into Tau and those guys were rock stars. They were like, you see all those crew, we got 5 turns of work we can do, of good work to do on those crew, which that felt pretty good.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, you're right. It just, unless you got the right profiles, you got to have a reason for them now, which I like because it used to just be that if you had the ability to take indirect fire, it was always the best choice. And we want to avoid that as much as possible, you know, just those auto choices. Like I just said with the secondaries, you want to avoid auto choices. You always want to have a discussion about which is better.
I think that's to call, especially you can also... there's an opportunity to misplay there, and that in and of itself is kind of neat, you know, because you kind of put yourself in situations that are harder for you've done it to yourself, and so you've got to get creative on the tabletop.
Yes, yeah.
I like that. So I did also give the Aberrant the World of Trade I was talking about, made him objective secured, and then the one that
Nice.
They get like give him some extra wounds and heal because you can give the knight two warlord traits. That was kind of the most interesting thing with my opponent is that he's like, how many CP you starting with? Like, I'm like, almost all of them. He's like, oh, well, interesting, because we see a lot of people, you know, a lot of people I play against invest a lot into those pregame stratagems. Well, that actually is something you see at higher level competitive plays. Like most players that do really well seem to start the game with 4, 5, 6, 8 CP. They don't start with the full boat.
Or they specifically play only with things like battalions so that they can pay all those upfront benefits and still have a decent bank of CP.
Yeah. So with this, with the Chaos Knights, let's just say that they're seemingly selfish. I didn't find myself wanting to invest CP into what was a War Dog chassis knight, because what I found in playing so far is that, you know, you can get the blood shield, and the blood shield is great and it's awesome on a carnivore, but then you're painting a giant red flag, red target. Red target of corn on your man. Where's red when you need him? He'll be here next week. Don't worry. You're basically painting a giant target on what is objectively an easier target for your opponent.
Mm. Yeah, and anytime you can make your opponent's life hard, their target priority hard, confuse them about what is the optimum or best thing to do, you probably should. You never want to be like, you see this one? This is the one I need the most.
So invest a couple of CP in the beginning of the game. Make your one model as hard to kill as you possibly can. And there's multiple ways to do that. There's a couple of different ways to find durability in the Chaos Knight book. And that's what I went with mostly, is like a little bit of insurance, a bit of buffer in case, things went horribly wrong in my, I got way out of position or had a bad round of rolling or something. But I enjoyed it. I definitely enjoyed the experience. We're going to see them. We're going to see knights variety on the table.
There's so many people who I know have a knight army or have a knight because, for so many editions, well, they only came out in 7th edition. But in 7th edition, they were amazing. In 8th edition, when there was souping was highly beneficial. You used to see armies all over the place who pack a single knight of whatever stripe or variety. So everyone's got them lying around. So you're very, very much going to see them.
Yeah, and they also get, the Agents of Chaos and Agents of the Imperium.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you still get a bunch of benefits. Well, you just don't lose anything when you take them now, which is, I think, a great thing.
I forget when we were talking about it, but, it might have been, Red, as it mentioned, it's like, what's the best artillery for Astra Militarum right now? And it's like, well, it's a knight.
Well, yeah, exactly right. I mean, you talk about what a Lehman Russ brings to the table. A knight brings that, two Lehman Russes stuck together if it's a Crusader. Plus, it's got an invulnerable save and it can, act at full profile. And it's got a lot better stratagem support for longevity.
It's fun moving the knights around. I think the autocannon knights, they put out a ton of damage.
I think the autocannon knights are in a great spot. And they kind of are hurting on the AP side of things still, even with what they've got, because, you're shooting at a Space Marine in cover. They just get to take their armor save. But, you have a bucket of attacks with the right damage profile, you're still going to get some through.
And that's what I found I was shooting at like Hammerheads and Devilfish. And they kind of tore through them.
Oh, they would do a number. Yeah. Perfect targets.
And they were also gave me a little bit of backfield presence, which I do like to play the assault based army still. Yeah.
What?
Really?
So,
no.
Man, I never knew that. That's just
even that aberrant, the psyker gets to get up and mix it up a little bit. the big cannon it has, it's a Volkite, suffers a little bit on the AP, but can dish out mortal wounds.
Yeah, amazing.
And it all adds up. And it was, you can have some pretty explosive turns. And the carnivores, I don't know how many you need, but I did enjoy the extra movement and the hitting on twos in close combat.
Does anyone want to see more Volkite weapons in 40K? I mean, they're an absolute staple in Horus Heresy, which of course is getting a phenomenal amount of support soon. I'd love to see even more Volkite weapons. Like, I'd love to be able to, a Devastator kit. We had Grav cannons, in the scheme of things, come out recently compared to the rest of them. They're still 7-8 years old now, the old Grav cannon. But I'd love to see
just because they look so gnarly, or you just like the profile of
cool. They're so cool. Yeah. You're absolutely right. They look gnarly, they are gnarly. They're a very unique profile, AP and strength wise, with I'd love to see Deflagrate, which is the rule they have in Horus Heresy at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is if you do a wound, you get more damage because it's the Volkite just kind of jumping from source to source, which I think is just freaking awesome.
Yeah, I do like how some of that, like there's a, you can look at the vehicles and they just act differently than they did in the Heresy. I think the Malkador is a good example of that. In Heresy, they're like known for their speed. And when you get up to 40K, it's like their engines have not stood the test of time. It's very deliberate. I'm pretty sure it's the Malkador.
That case. Would make sense.
Yeah. I could be getting the chassis wrong, but I think that there's definitely a tank that fits that profile. Like it's super speedy and fast in Heresy. And kind of dilapidated in some part in it, you know, not built the same as, you know, a Lehman Russ.
Ball Pred.
The Ball Predator.
Sorry, I had to cough there. Yeah. I had to cough there. It's fine.
I would like to tell you about the history of the Ball Predator.
I'm ready.
How much time do we have?
I would take 2 minutes, then we'll take a break. The Ball Predator.
I mean, it's Paul's show, so you can kind of make us do whatever you want.
I know people want to know about the Pred, but it did not originate on Ball. The Blood Angels took it, and when the Mechanicus showed up, like, yo, we're going to need that STC, they were like, get out of here, it's ours now.
I like that.
I thought you were going to say that the STC was found by some guy with last name of Ball.
Ball.
That's a whole nother bit of lore. that's one of the reasons that the Blood Angels and the Mechanicus were feuding, which led us to that kind of interesting period in Fifth where the Blood Angels had the deep striking Land Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, we'll do what we want. It's our vehicles, and so it was like that times 10, you know, whatever.
We'll yeet them from orbit if we want. What are you gonna do?
Yeah, what are you gonna come? You're gonna excommunicate us again? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
We've already pulled over. We can't pull over any further.
At least it's not as bad as that crap the space was made up about.
Excuse
not
me?
Being warp in. No, what? Huh? Sorry.
What? I checking all the boxes.
Red's not here to sass everybody, so I feel like I gotta, you know, up my tempo.
I appreciate you picking up that torch.
Yeah, it's I'm a feeble, pale imitation.
But it's been a bit since, I know that's not the first time we mentioned that story on the show, but I always thought it was fascinating. Like it was one of the coolest entries in the Imperial Armor book, you know, back when you got the, it came with, they were like thick books and they were dedicated to only specific factions and there were pages of lore in there. And yeah, it's that STC did not originate on Ball. It was found somewhere else. I can't remember the homebrew. We'll give a special like no prize. A solid thank you. If people can remember what planet they found it on.
A digital pat on the back.
Yeah. We'll definitely slide that a retweet. But I can't remember. I just remember being, that is so cool. Deep Striking Land Raiders, also cool, by the way. Although I never felt right doing it.
That's good. You have no shame. I appreciate that.
Look, sometimes you gotta, if you can throw a Land Raider from orbit, I mean, who doesn't really want to do that? Who hasn't thought about it?
It's like, well, it's almost like your patriotic duty.
Yeah.
To Baal. Have you got a WWSG tattoo yet?
What was Sanguinius too?
That's right. You got it. You're picking up what I'm putting down, baby.
Maybe. I'll give you a maybe on that.
It's on his butt.
We have to play our night battle and whoever loses the night battle has to get that tattoo.
Okay. Oh, you make me get the freaking.
No, you can get you can get WWTL do.
Oh, yeah. What would the lion do?
Yeah.
Can you guys like as a lower back tattoo with wings around it?
Yes. Oh, because they're both angels. Yes.
Yes.
Totally, so the template totally could be universal, and then we fill it.
Yeah. Yeah. I like this idea, actually.
I love it. It's
got potential.
On that note, let's take a break and let's talk with Kicker. As a Kicker is a nice palate cleanser. Then we'll come back with talking about a little bit about like getting ready for tournaments in general and how to get those 10 points everybody needs for their score. We'll see you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul. This is a special community spotlight segment. I'm joined by Kicker Kalazdi from the Frontline Gaming Network, man. How are you doing?
Hey, dude. Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. Thank you for the getting my name correct. That my last name is pretty unique. I'm cursed or blessed with a socially awkward first name and a complicated last name. So I just roll with it, man.
I've seriously read it differently every time than look at it. So just thanks for answering the call.
I try. Yeah, man. I mean, as you know, Paul, you know, I'm over on Signals every Wednesday, Signals from the Frontline. And I know you're over on Thursday right after us. You're the really, really popular show. We're just like, you know, we're your ugly sibling trying to keep up.
We talk about tournaments and upcoming things, but there's lots of shows on the network. So, you know, if people are looking for ways to find, you know, fill their day with Warhammer 40,000 and other stuff, they should definitely check us out over there. But I brought you on because I want to talk about events.
Yeah, my like main job
and stuff. You know, that's really because, you know, I've been going to some of these events, been, you know, love going to events in general. I consider it almost like the natural progression is kind of what I say of our hobby experience. And so, you know, if people don't know where to start or some events to start with, then I thought it'd be great to have you on and talk about some of those things.
Yeah, totally, man. Well, for those of you guys that don't know, I am the events manager for Frontline Gaming. So my full-time life now, my full career is just circling around the events and how to make them bigger and better. And you know, I said bigger and better, but that's not necessarily – bigger doesn't necessarily mean better, right? You can have small events that are just totally amazing. And that – like our Cherokee event we did in February, that was still, you know, about 240K players, but it was – epic. It was such a cool venue and everyone had such a great time. But yeah, I think that you're right. It is the natural progression, right? People start off, you know, playing in their garage with some buddies. Then they go to a local RTT, and from that RTT, it's a GT. And the next thing you know, they're at the LVO. And it is interesting how people go through that progress. What was your first RTT? Do you remember it, Paul?
First RTT.
Yeah, your first RTT, man.
I don't know if I specifically remember my first RTT, but I definitely remember some early ones in a small game store. I think it was in Alpharetta. It's right outside of the northeast side of Atlanta. I'd play, you know, my buddies, and of course, you know, started, you know, oh man, you know, I'm really liking how this is going. I'm starting to feel like I'm doing pretty well at this. Let me go test my mettle somewhere else. And for me, that's what it started out as, is let me go test my mettle. But I will say that over the period of time, it's evolved into, let me go hang out with my buddies that I only see 3 or 4 times a year.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, for me, like one of the first RTDs I went to was like, oh, hey, my buddy's going to that. I'll tag along. I got to meet him. I got to meet all his other friends. And then that was great. Right. And then I also saw like, hey, I got one day, but I got 3 games in, like 3 good games in. Like, this was awesome. So I immediately got bit by the bug. And then the GT was the next thing. Right. You know, I want to go to, now I get a whole weekend getting to spend like couple days with all my friends and getting to meet even more friends because there's more people there. It just kind of progressed to that. But I think what's really cool is that once I got to the GT level, right, start going to GTs, and then eventually, you know, the majors, the, you know, the Frontline Gaming events or whatever, it's like the pageantry of the hobby really started to take center place, at least for me. You know,
I want to show out. They bring their coolest stuff. It is a place to see and be seen.
It is a beauty pageant, man. Totally. And I'm like, but it also inspired me to paint better. Like, I went there and I wanted to have the most beautiful army I could do. And I remember going to my first LVO and I was like all gung ho, like I'm going to be the best one there. And then I got humbled real quickly when I saw some of the really amazing paint jobs and display boards and whatnot. But it was fun. Like, it was fun for me to go and push myself to get better at painting, but also just to like win or lose, you still get to walk around the hall and see the best painted armies in the world at some of these larger events. So, you know, you got the friendship, you got the competitive side, and then you got the hobby side of all these events.
I think you actually mentioned a great point earlier, is that you do get, you know, let's say it's a 5 game you know, tournament, you get 5 games of Warhammer 40,000 over a course of a couple of days. Sometimes that's more than people get in a quarter, but you know, you get to, you know, I'll experience it in one day with people that are really dedicated just as much as you are. But let's talk about the Frontline Gaming events specifically, as they've always been great events. I mean, some of the banner events in our, I was going to say sport, you know, but
it's a sport. We can call it a sport. I'm good with that. It's a sport.
You know, in our hobby, in our things, just like some of the banner events. And I think, you know, a contributor to that, especially now, is the enthusiasm that you bring to the events.
Thanks,
man. You know, so what's the next one coming up?
Okay, well, when I started with Frontline, right, when they brought me on, they basically had 3, you know, I guess, portfolio events, right? We had the LVO, which everyone knows and loves. We had the BAO and SoCal. And you'll know most of those events are West Coast. And I came on and I've been really pushing to grow more events. So now we're at about 8 events and they're, you know, across the country. But what I'm really trying hard to do is make sure that we do events that are all consistently well run. You know, we're a professional events company. So I want each event to be professionally run and consistent and have judges that kind of have the same sort of ruling across the spectrum. But I want each event to be worth going to because it's going to be a slightly different experience. Like, I want people to go to LVO and get the spectacle that is LVO, but I want them to go to Cherokee or the Lone Star Open that's coming up and have those be distinct experiences that, like, make it worth your time to fly to different parts of the country or drive to different parts of the country so that, you know, it's not just another 40K event. It's a 40K event with something extra.
A little personality. Something you can only get in that one specific venue.
Yeah. I mean, like, in Cherokee, which I'm really proud because Cherokee was, like, kind of a really weird event to run. It was not in a major city. It's out on the Cherokee Reservation out in North Carolina. And, like, it's kind of not near much, you know. It's up in the mountains. It's a gorgeous town. But recent thinking, you know, really the guys that run FLG, you know, the owners of Frontline, were like, are you sure you want to do that? It's kind of, you know, like, that's kind of a weird place to do it. But I really studied the area. I realized what's within driving distance. And, the event went really well. And what I did for that event is to make it, you know, lean into the culture there, the Cherokee culture. So we actually had, I really worked with the local tribe, got to get to know some of them, the guys there, and the tribe came and did like a tribal war blessing, basically, you know, before the event, which is so bad. To see that, man, you know, Texas, of course, we're going to have barbecue and we're going to be leaning into the Texas, everything that is Texas. I can't
argue
wait
with that.
Oh my gosh, dude, that's
the barbecue for sure.
Barbecue for sure. You know it, man. You know it. And I don't want to release too much information because I'm literally working on the Texas swag right now.
Suspense. That's some fine. Suspense. Okay.
But the Texas custom dice we're doing are going to be ones for the books, man. They're just so freaking cool. So, you know, and then of course we have BAO. BAO is later this month. That's the end of May. Mm-hmm. And that's got its own total different vibe. So it's kind of fun to go to these events because each one will give you a slightly different experience. I know you've been to LVO. We got to get you to Cherokee, man. Or, I mean, we got Texas. You should come on down to Texas. I know it's a far away for you. But
I do like the events. You know, it's same thing. You know, I kind of like have to juggle my travel schedule, work schedule, you know, home life, like everyone does. Everyone has to do that. But what I want to mention that to everyone listening is that these events are what I consider destinations events.
Yeah,
if you can make it to one or all of them, it is going to be fulfilling and worth it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And Frontline Gaming is really good at every event you go to, you're going to get this really cool, unique Frontline Gaming challenge coin. If you're in the military, you know exactly what a challenge coin is. If you're not in the military, just Google challenge coin and you look up at the history about it. But basically you get this, you know, die cast, beautiful, you know, coin that has the events, you know, obviously the date and stuff on and the event artwork on that. And that's something you can keep forever. But a lot of people are really enjoying kind of Pokemoning this, right? Like trying to catch them all, you know, get all their challenge coins. And they give you certain perks at other events if you bring them. But yeah, even if you can only make it to one event, you're going to be able to forever remember that event because of this cool challenge coin you get to keep. You know, Paul, you know, is there one thing in a particular, you know, one thing that you've always loved at a better event? Like, was it the camaraderie? Was it the after dinner, you know, meal? I mean, the after game dinner you had? Like, is there something at events that you just absolutely love that you always look forward to?
Yeah, what you hear time and time again is the friends that you make. Like, I will say that, and this is something that's a common theme, but some of my best friends in the world are people that I've met at Warhammer tournaments over the years.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, the camaraderie that forms, right? I know that we're just playing with toy soldiers, but it's still a battlefield, right? And the camaraderie that is formed after a 3-hour experience playing 40K or any one of the other game systems with somebody is pretty cool. You're saying this and it makes me realize, like, I'm thinking about my closest friends. I think my closest friends now are all people I've met through this hobby, which just is mind-boggling considering, you know, I used to have my friends all be gym rats or from running groups or from college, and it's like my closest friends now are 40K people, which is really pretty cool.
It's a little bit easier, you know, with the internet being what it is now. You know, people are, you know, kind of accessible, you can find folks. But, you know, for a while, you would go to these things and you just start to see the same people over and over again at these things. Yeah. Like, oh, you know, I wonder what they're about. You know, let's go over and check it out. You know, oh, this is I can see that you know, this army has progressed since the last time I saw them, or whatever, you know, or I'm finally in the same bracket that they are, you know, so now I might get to play this person that I've never really met, but I know is done really well. You know, you see that kind of thing, and that plays out on the tabletop.
Yeah, so something I'm trying to really do is obviously all these tournaments, not just ours, but every tournament has the tournament take place, but I'm trying to create, you know, opportunities to continue hanging out with these people once the dice stop rolling, right? Because, you know, after, you know, yeah, it's late, but I still want people to go hang out, right? So we work with different bars. We have a cool for Lone Star Open in the summer, we have like a cool meet and greet kind of thing happening with some free food from sponsors. So I want people to be able to like still hang out and get this opportunity to really, you know, develop those friendships further, as opposed to just, you know, play your dice, hang out, get the number, hopefully meet them at the next tournament. Like here, we've got some restaurants that you can go hang out at, you know. So that's something that is kind of why Cruise Hammer became what it is. People love Cruise Hammer, yes, because you get to play some 40K, but also because you get to spend an entire week with your closest friends on a cruise hanging out. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Dude, Cruise Hammer's in August, and I have never been, so I can only speak from what I've heard. But I have been focused a lot on the back end of that, getting that event ready. And it looks awesome because it's exactly what you've always wanted. It's 40K and a lot of time to hang out with your buds. So, yeah, I think that's something that with Frontline I'm really trying to help cultivate even more so, is opportunities to keep on hanging out with your friends, even if it's not at the table.
I know that we're basically just like gushing with enthusiasm over the tournament experience, but I legitimately feel this way. I'm probably going to talk more about it during the course of this show that this is going to be on. But where can people find more information about the events you're talking about and the shows you run and all that?
Yeah, I mean, everything for Frontline Gaming is on frontlinegaming.org, but we have this ridiculously active and positive and enjoyable community on Facebook. If you guys don't use Facebook because you're too young or too old, you should use Facebook for one reason and one reason only, because of the Frontline Gaming Community Facebook page. It's pretty easy to find, and it's just a really good place to ask questions about upcoming tournaments, whether they're your tournament, Frontline Gaming tournament or not, but also just to, like, you know, there's really funny memes that get posted on there, right? It's a way to know about the brand new swag we're releasing. So that's a lot of fun. And of course, if you listen to podcasts, which you're probably listening to this Forge the Narrative right now, you probably listen to other podcasts as well. You know, the entire Frontline Gaming Network is a pretty good place for Frontline Gaming event info as well.
Well, Kicker, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, definitely, man. Though, thank you for the. I am honored, man. Totally honored. You are on the legendary Paul Murphy show.
Thank you. Well, it's always great to run into you at these events. You know, and again, you can tell that you're really concerned. You know, you care about people's good times, and it does. It just translates. So I definitely want to direct people to check out what you've been talking about and see if it's right for them.
Yeah, guys. And please, if you're at any one of the Frontline Gaming events, please come up and say hi. I love meeting everyone. So, you know, I'm the short guy that speaks really fast. So I look forward to seeing you guys on the at one of the shows, at one of the events.
Everybody hang tight. We're going to come back with the rest of the crew. Kicker, we'll see you.
Thanks, Paul.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
We are back. Still got Tanya and Adam here.
Hey, everybody.
You see what I mean about Kicker? I mean, that was, you know, it's an experience.
It is
a bundle of enthusiasm.
I would like 10% of his energy. Just 10%, you know?
Yeah, good times. Don't forget to check out these tournaments. Like, we're kind of, like, blessed with the fact that there are a bunch of quality events, you know, happening all over the U.S. And I know internationally, too, which we talk about on the 30. I'm just like, look, we're all over the place talking about Warhammer all the time. So there's kind of a way to kind of fill your whole day with us, I mean, if you wanted to.
Yeah, sooner or later, we're just going to have a 24-hour content loop, like, you know, 24-hour news, but it's just 24-hour 40K. And you can forget the rest of the world exists. It's going to be a beautiful thing.
I'm out. I'm not in this. I did a daily podcast for like a year. I'm not doing it again.
It would be exhausting.
It was exhausting.
Sometimes we got to do it, you know. We'll do it, maybe not in a row, not 24 hours in a row, you know, over like 3 days.
Maybe we could have 24 times seven people all providing an hour a week.
Ooh, nice.
That's dual.
There we go. But so with the U.S. Open Series, and I will link that in, you know, we have San Diego coming up in a couple of weeks, and then we got Kansas City, Chicago, and then the finals in New Mexico. And the finals are doing it differently than we did last year. You can come to these things and compete for a spot in the finals of the events, but there's going to be other things to do other than just, you know, compete, you know, the finals, quote unquote, for the series. at the New Mexico event. So check it out. These are, you know, we've talked about and talked about the first part of the show and even in the slot with Kicker, you know, about destination events. Like if you could only go to one, these are good ones to pick and go to. And, you know, I'm so glad these things are coming back, you know, whether it be, you know, direct Games Workshop events or independent events, you know, really just happy to have them available to go to.
Do you ever wish that you were playing in them?
All the time.
Yeah.
I mean, no, I love it. I love talking about it. I love like sitting back and doing the analysis on the game. I love trying to guess what's going to happen in the game. Like that's really fun, but it's kind of hard to beat rolling dice and just the lead up. Like I know we said we're going to talk about some hobby stuff, but because that's part of it, like getting ready for the ritual of getting ready for a tournament, you know, making sure the squad's looking as sharp as it can, making sure when I have the whole squad and whatever war gear I've chosen to filthy meta chase. Go into the event, playing a few games, you know, having a few hours to chill in, you know, before you got to crash and get up and play some more games the next day. I love that thrill. And if anybody hasn't experienced it yet and wants to, you got any questions about how to do it, hit us up on social media. Happy to talk about it. Or, you know, listen to the show. Let us know what you want us to talk about. It is just it's a thrill. I do miss playing.
Absolutely, man. I'm playing a lot more at the moment, which, and I'm reveling in it somewhat. I'm just like back to a pig in the proverbial.
We were talking about display boards has been an interesting topic. You know, it's like how do you do it? Do you travel with them? You know, do you find ways, you know, do you incorporate them into your aesthetic, your what might be your paint points? Like, are they even required? Have we evolved past needing display boards or wanting display boards?
Well, see, I think we have and we haven't. So events are only getting bigger. The halls we're playing events in are only getting bigger. And everybody is carrying armies from table to table to table to table. No one wants to pack and unpack their army. Maybe if you're playing knights, whatever. You pack and unpack your army after every game. So we're all carrying them. Everyone's got trays, you know. I raise your hand if you listen to us right now. Raise your hand if you've stolen a tray from McDonald's. Raise two hands if you've stolen
maybe not
a tray
if you're driving.
And KFC and. And several others. Yes, I've raised one of my feet now because I'm the proud owner of three fast food trays.
I've borrowed them from the hotel, but I've asked. It's like, yo, do you mind if I use this? And of course, they don't care.
Yeah.
I've only been to one tournament where I could fit my whole army onto a fast food tray. So when I was playing guard, I actually had to go out and like buy a giant tray. I went to like it's like a store that you go to for like wholesale restaurant stuff, and they had these giant trays that they used. I guess pizza restaurants use them to like raise dough or something like that. Okay. It's giant and it's really deep, and I had to buy one of those to move my guard around from table to table because it was just so many models.
I used to put the tanks in my pockets. I'm not gonna lie. The infantry would be on the tray, and then when it came time to move, I would just put a Lehman Russ or two in my pocket so I could they'd all fit on the tray.
Because the Lehman Russ is like in like cargo pants.
I wish I was that cool. No, my socks, sandals, and cargo pants the combo.
Innovation.
Like I'd have a big front pocket in your hoodie. I could flit two Manticores and two Lehman Russes in that bad boy. Whoa. And you know, because they're very sturdy tanks. They're built good by the Imperium right now, you know. They're good stuff. And you know, I get from table to table. It was actually pretty good. But yeah, so we're all going places, you know, there's a lot more people traveling post pandemic and getting out there back to events. If you're gonna carry your stuff from table to table, you know, display board is the way to do it in style, do it in class and get some oohs and ahs on the way there.
Yeah.
So one of my friends, he usually works like he plays at this one tournament, but he was judging the paint while I was there, and he like tisked me because I didn't have a display board, and I felt like I felt the social shame. So I actually commissioned one finally, so he can stop tisking me.
A little bit of peer pressure to get that Display board's happening.
Yeah.
Reach that brass ring.
Yeah, but I just don't feel like I have the desire to make one myself. And even it, and then because I don't have the desire, I feel like if I made one, it would just look like poo. So
Is that because of the mediums that they're normally done, either with like the plastic terrain or cut carving foam? Is there a part of it that you think, like, what do you think is causing you to feel that way?
It's the foam. I just imagine it being like a giant mess in my tiny house. And I just, if I had a garage, I feel like I would give it a go, but I don't. And I don't really want to like do it in my house.
Yeah, no, all good reasons. I was just curious as to what, what you felt the obstacle might be.
Yeah. Which part of it you found intimidating or too much or not worth it?
I don't know if it's like intimidating. I think I just don't want to deal with the cleanup and like, yeah.
Yeah, it's a process. Yeah, I'm with
you. Yeah, because I feel like I'd have to move like everything off of my paint desk in order to have enough room to like build it. And then I would make a mess because I'm like a tornado. And then I'd have to clean it up. And yeah. And it was just, there's this guy that is local to me that makes amazing D&D terrain. And I just like rang him up. I was like, dude, can you do this for me? And he was like, yeah.
Man, I like that though. That's supporting like a local, you know, little nerd business, which I think is adorable, and you should support those people in your community.
Yeah. He's doing me a solid too, because it's like less than a month to go and he did it in less than a week and it looks like 100 times better than anything that, like, he did like a resin pour in this thing.
Oh, wow. Like a one of those clear resin to make it like water or ice or something?
Yeah. It's like he made it so it's like brilliant. A frozen lake. So like ogres are basically like outrunning the Everwinter. It's like this magical snowstorm, right? It even freezes ghosts.
Ooh, AOS loves his magical weather.
That's right. So, but at the same time, like my army is in Gur, which is like, I guess it's almost desert-like, right? So it's like desert, but it's frozen desert. And he just aced it.
So what are you envisioning? Like, what's the so the settings are a frozen lake. The lads just standing around trying not to crack anything, like they're being all dainty.
So I love the idea of that. It's like a desert scape, but it has like a little, it's like a, like an alkaline lake in the middle of a desert. I'm sure that you've sort of seen it. So it's like a little pond and it's got like a mesa on it and it's got, yeah, it's got tons of texture and a little bit of shrubbery.
I already love it. Do you know why? It's got a shrubbery.
It's got shrubbery.
It's shrubbery.
It's vital. Vital to the whole operation.
That's right.
I don't think there's anything like wrong with commissioning any part of your army. Like, not everybody has either the inclination, the skill, the parts, the time. You know, there's some part of that equation or whatever that is just not for everyone. And so getting someone to do that part or any part, not a big deal.
After like two years of getting tisked and like not making the display board, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to admit I'm not going to do it. So I'll find somebody who
there's,
will.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that at all.
But I want to extend that to like even like power weapons or lenses on eyes. You know, like if you got a buddy that's willing to help you out with that, take advantage of it. I mean, there's something about like you just practice until you get to a level that you like, but you know, shortcut that, get those points. I mean, if you ask me anyway, that's
I like when armies are like a collaborative effort. Like, I would love to collaborate on an army with somebody at some point. I think it would be so cool.
I love that too. I love, so that's one of the things I've been a little bit inspired, hobby wise since Adepticon, because it's just the pageantry of it is something I haven't had in my local events in a little bit. Not that there's the hobby level is lacking at all, but that level, that crazy, just let's just go ham and see what we can produce
between you
and a couple of mates.
Yeah.
And the whole event is just, is all in. You know, everybody on the event is just all in on this. I think it's incredible.
Yeah.
And so it's got me being like, you know, what can I do? What can I do to jazz up and, you know, capture a bit of that magic?
Yeah, I do think that if and I always say this before, but I think it's worth repeating, is that if a tournament publishes any sort of painting checklist or a rubric or whatever, I really think it's on them to follow that when they're divvying out their points.
Absolutely.
And I think that it's a good thing to aspire to see if you can meet those objectives.
Mm-hmm.
If you're like trying to ramp your hobby game up, or if you're wanting to compete in every level of whatever event you're going to, if that's part of the scoring of the event. So that's one of the things that I've done over the years. Cause again, I paint to the rubric. I paint for points. I'm comfortable with the fact that personally I will, if the sample size is large enough, I know I'm not leaving with best painted ever. And I'm okay with that. Cause you know, there's,
yeah,
that's just reality. I've my expectations are set, I think, appropriately, but I love painting for the point side of it.
And I just love painting.
Me too. But I paint because I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've gotten there. It's taken me a long time.
I also think that I will never win best painted.
I don't know. Just... You got good color choices, good composition. Yeah. Like there's a lot going on.
Yeah, but I've seen like what other people in my local area put out, and I just I'm nowhere near that, you know?
Yeah.
Unless they move away.
Well, you just playing for different things, you know, that's it. I mean, but you know, again, I'm not begrudging any of those best painted. Like talent is talent. And sometimes it's also in the eye, like eye of the beholder. Like what I encourage organizers to do is, even when you have like a hard coded, like checklist of what you're looking for to judge paint scores, reserve that best painted award, like print it into your documentation that the best painted award, the best is subjective and will be awarded subjectively, but you know, don't deny anybody their points.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm kind of the opinion that I like when an event has a TO's choice and a player's choice. And I like and also a best painted, like I do like deep hobby scored events. So, cause I think there's a good case for saying that, you know, the votes of your peers determine which army was the best painted at the event, you know?
You have to kind of do that.
The peers. Yeah, yeah. Everyone has to vote. You get a 1-2-3 votes or 2 votes, whatever it may be. And then, you know, those are the people who get best painted. It can be, you know, the first, second, third of that as well. But I love TO's choice, because it's the TOs can go around and they can, you know, they can see a regular who maybe not the best painter, but you can reward effort and see like this person pushed themselves. They went above and beyond. They've got a brand new display board. It's obvious they put, you know, extra. It's not the best highlight.
Most improved from 3 months ago to now. Now they're squad marked, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. Opportunity to reward effort, which I think that's just as important as rewarding those people who just those who just have like all that natural freakish talent, which I just don't understand.
Back in the day, we would often, I mean, this is like, you know, years and years and years ago, we would often not reward the same army with best painted. So like the guy would show up and it's immaculate, it's gorgeous. But the next time he brought that to the same community, then he knew he wasn't winning the best paint at that time. Somebody else was going to win it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind that as well. There's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with that either. If you've seen the same army on the same display board 6 or 7 times, that's why I like the 1-2-3 voting. Like you reward, you know, you reward awesome with awesome. But sometimes if you haven't seen something for the first time, maybe that gets your first vote at that event. And that guy who you've seen 3 or 4 times with the same gorgeously beautiful army gets your second vote or your third vote. Like stuff like that is totally fine.
Yeah, I think that's what we're saying. Is a lot of power, of course, in the individual organizers themselves, but there's multiple different ways to approach this. And I think as long as you like communicate what that is, then everybody knows what's up. But also, like, I just like getting ready for these things. And now battle ready is part of your score, and like how to achieve battle ready, and what criteria goes into that is, you know, the original topic, is the display board part of that, or is even that just kind of like the cherry on top?
Yeah. What are some basic tenets about what you should try and look for when, you know, building, envisioning a display board? Like what should they have on them?
I like to see depth, you know, either in height, and if you can get like a bit of a narrative just, you know, displayed between the basing of your miniatures in the composition of your army and how it complements the board.
I like that. I like
where the board complements your army, you know, or vice versa.
Yeah, I think that's really good. If it's a flat piece, like if it's just like a realm of battle tile, it needs to be telling a story. Like, you know, it needs to have something to catch the eye. So you know it's actually a display board and it's not just a tile you use to go from place to place. You know?
Or the tray from the hotel. You know, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with this, with a flat. I mean, I love depth. I love seeing, or I love a reason to look behind a corner on a display board or look behind a wall or on the other side of something, like something to catch my eye or little touches. I remember, and this isn't in 40K. This is in Infinity. There was a guy who had all these little posters. And you could read the freaking – he had a magnifying glass next to his display board, and you could read the posters if you wanted to. And that kind of stuff is just ingenious in creating intrigue and thematic effect. And, like, the story, the fluff for his narrative was printed on the posters, the conflict, and you magnifying glass the – yeah, incredible, incredibly ingenious.
No, that sounds – well thought out and pretty darn cool.
It was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And that was at my first ever CanCon. So that was like one of the first like truly big events I'd ever been to. And I was playing fantasy at the time. And that was just like caught my imagination entirely.
And I've seen lots of things. I've never seen that. Something like that. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely bonkers.
Going to put that in the, the things of to break out.
Yes. Yeah. If one day when I'm retired and bored and got 1,000,000,000 hours, maybe I too will print tiny text on posters.
Well, and also provide an attachment for, you know.
Yeah. Because it was the fluff of his army as well. Like it was the narrative of what he was doing.
Oh, very cool.
Which I thought was the extra level to it.
Oh, if it's Infinity though, you could just do like QR codes everywhere and get people to scan it. It could bring up all your fluff. God.
Yeah. That's next level. Holy crap.
See, we're over here just kind of, part-time in it, and Tanya took us to the next level.
Yeah, dead set. This is what we talk about these things, though, because, like, no one has all the ideas. No one's imagination is complete and total. Yeah, everything gets better by sharing it.
I agree. You know what? I'm never going to use that idea. So if somebody wants to steal it and use it and then share it with me, then I could live vicariously through their hard work.
Yeah, spot on. And if anybody figures out who that was with the tiny Infinity posters, you let me right know, because I'd love to get some photos or figure out who that was.
Give them an internet thumbs up.
Absolutely.
Give them a reach.
But yeah. So, Paul, you've done many ATCs, Adepticon topologies, and you've designed numerous display boards. How do you go about it? Like, do you start with, theory crafting a setting or a piece of fluff which to design around, or do you start with what army you want to go on the display board? Or
that's a great question. The first step is actually making sure that you have a board that's big enough, the right size for the army that you are trying to display.
That seems logical.
Which is, it used to be we just go get a 2x2 pre-cut square from Home Depot and, put some foam on it, cut around the edge and make it look slightly, whatever, and go. But now not every army fits on 2x2. Not every army is, needs a 2x2 size. It might need a smaller size. You start looking into the logistics, like, what am I using this for? Am I only going to use this for local tournaments, or am I going to use it for a travel tournament? So 2 years ago, when I was planning on traveling to Adepticon for the team, my display board build was specifically designed to fit in great cost to size ratio FedEx boxes.
Ah, nice. So you actually built it with travel in mind.
Yeah, it was like 11¾ inches square and 18 inches high. And it was they would fit on each other like a tower. So by the end of it, it'd be, 5 feet taller and a foot square around the sides, 14 That's inches genius. Or whatever the box was. And then built each individual section of that to be its own kind of narrative. It was going to look like you had the Death Company in the basement with like may or may not be bloody stuff, and rituals and like fountains of blood down there. You'd go up to the fortress entrance, and then you'd go into like the dreadnought, I don't know, reliquary repository. I don't even know where the dreadnoughts hang out, wherever that is. And then you'd go into the heavens. It was going to be like clouds and where the Sanguinary Guard were, like one of those Renaissance reliefs.
Amazing.
It never got completed because 2020 happened. So,
But do you still have it like a whip and like a work in progress?
I do actually, because I keep, you know, kind of flirting. I built everything but the top level because it was going to be mostly like pillars kind of poking out of clouds. And I was planning on doing the clouds with a bunch of not gauze, but whatever, like cottony, like go to the craft stores and get like a big bundle of
the batten.
Yeah. Like, and pull it apart to where it's all spread out. And so it looks kind of like clouds, and, you know, was going to attempt to airbrush it till it looked like you had some depth into that. That was the idea. In my head, it's looking a lot better than it probably was going to look in. But you get what I'm saying. It's like, so, you know, how do you go about it? Like, it was at a form slash function and then had an idea on travel versus not travel. And I think that's how you try to find one. You can like measure out how much actual space your army needs to occupy on the table. And then you got to make a decision. Do you want like bases sunk into to where they looks like everyone's sitting on the ground, or are you fine with their bases just being placed on the thing? There's all kind of decisions you got. And I'm not saying this to be like intimidating, because just trying it is good enough. Mm. But if you had to like make one calculation before you got started, just make sure it's the right size for the army that you're taking.
Yeah. Nothing's going to hurt you more than having the wrong size tool or backing or whatever you want to call it.
And then you can go, like, we're kind of like in a great spot with plastic kits for scenery and terrain. Like, you could get store-bought stuff or you could make stuff. And there's all kind of ways out there to make stuff.
Mm, that's really true.
I wouldn't, like, you could get by on the cheap with this if you put the hobby time in, you know, or you can get by spending a lot, you know, by going to get some of these pre-made kits.
And you know, well, while I it's still a big discussion in the community how we feel about 3D printing and all these things, this is where 3D printing is really at its heart, at its home, when you can literally just let your imagination run wild, and if you've got the time and the effort, you can probably find a way to get it built. So, you know, kind of go nuts with it. If you really have a vision for something you think's thematic and awesome, and you can get something that's going to look exactly how you want it, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and it can influence your army's basing decisions too. Like, if you've got, let's say you've got the ocean cresting on a beach or whatever, some of your basing could be the ocean, some of your basing could be the beach, you know, and it gives you some cool contrast between your models on the table.
I always had a vision for, I mean who hasn't had like a bajillion different armies knocking around in their heads and a bazillion different ideas for settings for armies. I love the idea of Necron tomb waking up underwater, and then the Necrons like walking out of the beach. Like, it's just creepy. It's a beautiful sunny day, and then there's just freaking Necrons like swampily wading out of, you know, covered in seaweed and barnacles, just wading out of the ocean. I love it. I love the idea. I got the idea from Pirates of the Caribbean, the second one, like all Davy Jones's crew, who they're all like barnacled up in, you know, half sea creature and stuff. And I thought Necrons, like, to that, like, painted along that aesthetic, not piratey, but just that encrusted, old, weathered age, and then just them walking, like, a beautiful Caribbean island, and then just menacingly, evilly walking out of the ocean.
That sounds pretty cool.
See, and I would do it at nighttime, because they're all, like, glowy and stuff, right? So I would, probably do it in a box, so it's, like, dark on the inside.
See, I didn't even think of that. I thought this would be better in daytime. So one of the... I don't know if you guys, I know you guys probably love Lord of the Rings as much as I do, or at least Paul does. One of my favorite scenes in all the trilogy, the original trilogy, was just the Nazgul riding through the Shire. Like, you just got these beautiful country roads, and then these 5-9 absolute monsters just riding through the streets on like on a beautiful like autumn day, spring day. And just like terrifying creatures just rocking around on a beautiful day. Seems to be like a juxtaposition that sticks in my head as something I want to capture.
I like it. You should do it.
Yeah. I think we're talking ourselves into some pretty epic display boards.
That's all this section was. Just us wishlisting.
Just a little bit of confidence building to break it out. Hey, look, that's what we're here for. Let's hear y'all's ideas. Hit us up on...
I am here to inspire you to do all the things I don't have the time to do.
There we go. Well, see, this thing, eventually we see somebody else doing it, then we want to do it, then we, you know, get it, figure it out. That's our show this week. I know it's been a little bit long with the special guest, but we really appreciate Kicker taking the time to come on and share some of that with us. If y'all are so inclined, you know, please check out the Games Workshop US Open Series. Come join me at those. You'll see them. If you can't join us in person, make sure you check us out during the streams. But I'll put the link for all the stuff we talked about in the show notes, and yeah, check them out if you can. That's our show this week.
It's a good time.
We'll see y'all next week.
See you then, guys. Take care.
Bye, everybody.
What they said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.